about the constant traveling. How many days I wished I didn't have to get on a plane and could just be like a normal kid going to school and making friends. But I couldn't complain. "You always have to look impeccable," Dad had told me. And he didn't just mean my clothes. He meant my attitude. With Mom gone, I was all he had. Dad needed me to be strong. Most days I didn't mind. I loved my dad. But it was also hard. Sadie didn't understand that. She had it easy. And now she seemed to be getting all the attention, as if she were the special one. It wasn't fair. Then I heard Dad's voice in my head. "Fairness means everyone gets what they need. And the only way to get what you need is to make it happen yourself." I don't know what got into me, but I drew my sword and marched across the plank. It was like my legs were working by themselves, not waiting for my brain. Part of me thought, "This is a really bad idea." But part of me answered, "No, we do not fear this." And the voice didn't sound like mine. "Carter!" Sadie cried. I kept walking. I tried not to look down at the yawning void under my feet, but the sheer size of the chasm made me dizzy. I felt like one of those gyroscope toys, spinning and wobbling as I crossed the narrow plank. As I got closer to the opposite side, the doorway between the two statues began to glow, like a curtain of red light. I took a deep breath. Maybe the red light was a portal, like the gate of sand. If I just charged through fast enough. Then the first dagger shot out of the tunnel. My sword was in motion before I realized it. The dagger should have impaled me in the chest, but somehow I deflected it with my blade and sent it sailing into the abyss. Two more daggers shot out of the tunnel. I'd never had the best reflexes, but now they sped up. I ducked one dagger and hooked the other with the curved blade of my sword, turned the dagger, and flung it back into the tunnel. How the heck did I do that? I advanced to the end of the plank and slashed through the red light, which flickered and died. I waited for the statues to come alive, but nothing happened. The only sound was a dagger clattering against the rocks in the chasm far below. The doorway began to glow again. The red light coalesced into a strange form, a 5-foot-tall bird with a man's head. I raised my sword, but Zia yelled, "Carter, no!" The bird creature folded his wings. His eyes, lined with coal, narrowed as they studied me. A black ornamental wig glistened on his head, and his face was etched with wrinkles. One of those fake braided pharaoh beards was stuck on his chin like a backward ponytail. He didn't look hostile, except for the red flickering light all around him and the fact that from the neck down he was the world's largest killer turkey. Then a chilling thought occurred to me. This was a bird with a human head. The same form I'd imagined taking when I slept in Amos's house, when my soul left my body and flew to Phoenix. I had no idea what that meant, but it scared me. The bird creature scratched at the stone floor. Then, unexpectedly, he smiled. "Peri nisu nefir," he told me, or at least that's what it sounded like. Zia gasped. She and Sadie were standing behind me now, their faces pale. Apparently they'd managed to cross the chasm without my noticing. Finally, Zia seemed to collect herself. She bowed to the bird creature. Sadie followed her example. The creature winked at me, as if we'd just shared a joke. Then he vanished. The red light faded. The statues retracted their arms, uncrossing their spears from the entrance. "That's it?" I asked. "What did the turkey say?" Zia looked at me with something like fear.
"That was not a turkey, Carter. That was a ba."
I'd heard my dad use that word before, but I couldn't place it. Another monster?
"A human soul," Zia said. "In this case, a spirit of the dead. A magician from ancient times come back to serve as a guardian. They watch the entrances of the house."
She studied my face as if I'd just developed some terrible rash. "What?" I demanded. "Why are you looking at me that way?" Nothing, she said. We must hurry. She squeezed by me on the ledge and disappeared into the tunnel. Sadie was staring at me, too. All right, I said. What did the bird guy say? You understood it? She nodded uneasily.
He mistook you for someone else. He must have bad eyesight.
Because?
Because he said, go forth, good king.
I was in a daze after that. We passed through the tunnel and entered a vast underground city of halls and chambers, but I only remember bits and pieces of it. The ceiling soared to 20 or 30 feet, so it didn't feel like we were underground. Every chamber was lined with massive stone columns, like the ones I'd seen in Egyptian ruins, but these were in perfect condition, brightly painted to resemble palm trees, with carved green fronds at the top, so I felt like I was walking through a petrified forest. Fires burned in copper braziers. They didn't seem to make any smoke, but the air smelled good, like a marketplace for spices. Cinnamon, clove, nutmeg, and others I couldn't identify. The city smelled like Zia. I realized that this was her home. We saw a few other people, mostly older men and women. Some wore linen robes, some modern clothes. One guy in a business suit walked past with a black leopard on a leash, as if that were completely normal. Another guy barked orders to a small army of brooms, mops, and buckets that were scuttling around, cleaning up the city.
Like that cartoon, Sadie said, where Mickey Mouse tries to do magic and the brooms keep splitting and toting water.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice, Zia said. You do know that was based on an Egyptian story, don't you?
Sadie just stared back. I knew how she felt. It was too much to process. We walked through a hall of jackal-headed statues, and I could swear their eyes watched us as we passed. A few minutes later, Zia led us through an open-air market, if you can call anything open-air underground, with dozens of stalls selling weird items like boomerang wands, animated clay dolls, parrots, cobras, papyrus scrolls, and hundreds of different glittering amulets. Next, we crossed a path of stones over a dark river teeming with fish. I thought they were perch until I saw their vicious teeth. Are those piranhas? I asked.
Tiger fish from the Nile, Zia said. Like piranhas, except these can weigh up to 16 pounds.
I watched my step more closely after that. We turned a corner and passed an ornate building carved out of black rock. Seated pharaohs were chiseled into the walls, and the doorway was shaped like a coiled serpent.
What's in there? Sadie asked.
We peeked inside and saw rows of children, maybe 2 dozen in all, about 6 to 10 years old or so, sitting cross-legged on cushions. They were hunched over brass bowls, peering intently into some sort of liquid and speaking under their breath. At first I thought it was a classroom, but there was no sign of a teacher, and the chamber was lit only by a few candles. Judging by the number of empty seats, the room was meant to hold twice as many kids.
Our initiates, Zia said, learning to scry. The first gnome must keep in contact with our brethren all over the world. We use our youngest as operators, I suppose you would say.
So you've got bases like this all over the world?
Most are much smaller, but yes.
I remembered what Amos had told us about the gnomes. Egypt is the first gnome. New York is the 21st. What's the last one, the 360th?
That would be Antarctica, Zia said. A punishment assignment. Nothing there but a couple of cold magicians and some magic penguins.
Magic penguins?
Don't ask.
Sadie pointed to the children inside. How does it work? They see images in the water?
It's oil, Zia said. But yes.
So few, Sadie said. Are these the only initiates in the whole city?
In the whole world, Zia corrected. There were more before...
She stopped herself. Before what? I asked.
Nothing, Zia said darkly. Initiates do our scrying because young minds are most receptive. Magicians begin training no later than the age of 10, with a few dangerous exceptions.
You mean us, I said. She glanced at me apprehensively, and I knew she was still thinking about what the bird spirit had called me, a good king. It seemed so unreal, like our family name in that Blood of the Pharaoh scroll. How could I be related to some ancient kings? And even if I was, I certainly wasn't a king. I had no kingdom. I didn't even have my single suitcase anymore.
They'll be waiting for you, Zia said. Come along.
We walked so far, my feet began to ache. Finally, we arrived at a crossroads. On the right was a massive set of bronze doors with fires blazing on either side. On the left, a 20-foot-tall sphinx carved into the wall. A doorway nestled between its paws, but it was bricked in and covered in cobwebs.
That looks like the Sphinx at Giza, I said.
That's because we are directly under the real Sphinx, Zia said. That tunnel leads straight up to it, or it used to, before it was sealed.
But I did some quick calculations in my head. The Sphinx is like 20 miles from the Cairo airport.
Roughly.
No way we've walked that far.
Zia actually smiled, and I couldn't help noticing how pretty her eyes were.
Distance changes in magic places, Carter. Surely you've learned that by now.
Sadie cleared her throat.
So why is the tunnel closed, then?
The Sphinx was too popular with archaeologists, Zia said. They kept digging around. Finally, in the 1980s, they discovered the first part of the tunnel under the Sphinx.
Dad told me about that, I said, but he said the tunnel was a dead end.
It was when we got through with it. We couldn't let the archaeologists know how much they're missing. Egypt's leading archaeologist recently speculated that they've only discovered 30% of the ancient ruins in Egypt. In truth, they've only discovered 1/10. And not even the interesting 10th.
What about King Tut's tomb? I protested.
That boy king?
Zia rolled her eyes.
Boring. You should see some of the good tombs.
I felt a little hurt. Dad had named me after Howard Carter, the guy who discovered King Tut's tomb, so I'd always felt a personal attachment to it. If that wasn't a good tomb, I wondered what was.
Zia turned to face the bronze doors.
This is the Hall of Ages.
She placed her palm against the seal, which bore the symbol of the House of Life. The hieroglyphs began to glow, and the doors swung open. Zia turned to us, her expression deadly serious.
You are about to meet the Chief Lector. Behave yourselves, unless you wish to be turned into insects.
14. A French guy almost kills us. The last couple of days I'd seen a lot of crazy things, but the Hall of Ages took the prize. Double rows of stone pillars held up a ceiling so high you could have parked a blimp under it with no trouble. A shimmering blue carpet that looked like water ran down the center of the hall, which was so long I couldn't see the end, even though it was brightly lit. Balls of fire floated around like helium basketballs, changing color whenever they bumped into one another. Millions of tiny hieroglyphic symbols also drifted through the air, randomly combining into words and then breaking apart. I grabbed a pair of glowing red legs. They walked across my palm before jumping off and dissolving. But the weirdest things were the displays.
I don't know what else to call them. Between the columns on either side of us, images shifted, coming into focus and then blurring out again like holograms in a sandstorm.
Come on, Zia told us, and don't spend too much time looking.
It was impossible not to. The first 20 feet or so, the magical scenes cast a golden light across the hall. A blazing sun rose above an ocean. A mountain emerged from the water, and I had the feeling I was watching the beginning of the world. Giants strode across the Nile Valley. A man with black skin and the head of a jackal, a lioness with bloody fangs, a beautiful woman with wings of light. Sadie stepped off the rug. In a trance, she reached toward the images. "Stay on the carpet!" Zia grabbed Sadie's hand and pulled her back toward the center of the hall. "You are seeing the age of the gods. No mortal should dwell on these images."
"But," Sadie blinked, "they're only pictures, aren't they?"
"Memories," Zia said. "So powerful, they could destroy your mind."
"Oh,"
Sadie said in a small voice. We kept walking. The images changed to silver. I saw armies clashing, Egyptians in kilts and sandals and leather armor, fighting with spears. A tall, dark-skinned man in red and white armor placed a double crown on his head. Narmer, the king who united Upper and Lower Egypt. Sadie was right. He did look a bit like Dad.
"This is the Old Kingdom," I guessed.
"The first great age of Egypt." Zia nodded. As we walked down the hall, we saw workers building the first step pyramid out of stone. Another few steps, and the biggest pyramid of all rose from the desert at Giza. Its outer layer of smooth white casing stones gleamed in the sun. 10,000 workers gathered at its base and knelt before the pharaoh, who raised his hands to the sun, dedicating his own tomb.
"Khufu," I said.
"The baboon?" Sadie asked, suddenly interested. "No, the pharaoh who built the Great Pyramid," I said. "It was the tallest structure in the world for almost 4,000 years." Another few steps and the images turned from silver to coppery.
"The Middle Kingdom," Zia announced. "A bloody, chaotic time. And yet, this is when the House of Life came to maturity."
The scenes shifted more rapidly. We watched armies fighting, temples being built, ships sailing on the Nile, and magicians throwing fire. Every step covered hundreds of years, and yet the hall still went on forever. For the first time, I understood just how ancient Egypt was. We crossed another threshold, and the light turned bronze. "The New Kingdom," I guessed. "The last time Egypt was ruled by Egyptians." Zia said nothing, but I watched scenes passing that my dad had described to me. Hatshepsut, the greatest female pharaoh, putting on a fake beard and ruling Egypt as a man. Ramses the Great leading his chariots into battle. I saw magicians dueling in a palace. A man in tattered robes with a shaggy black beard and wild eyes threw down his staff, which turned into a serpent and devoured a dozen other snakes. I got a lump in my throat.
"Is that Musa?" Zia said. "Or Moshe, as his own people knew him. You call him Moses, the only foreigner ever to defeat the house in a magic duel."
I stared at her. "You're kidding, right?"
"We would not kid about such a thing."
The scene shifted again. I saw a man standing over a table of battle figurines, wooden toy ships, soldiers and chariots. The man was dressed like a pharaoh, but his face looked oddly familiar. He looked up and seemed to smile right at me. With a chill, I realized he had the same face as the Ba, the bird-faced spirit who challenged me on the bridge.
"Who is that?" I asked.
"Nektanebo II," Zia said, "the last native Egyptian king and the last sorcerer pharaoh. He could move entire armies, create or destroy navies by moving pieces on his board, but in the end, it was not enough."
We stepped over another line and the images shimmered blue.
"These are the Ptolemaic times," Zia said.
"Alexander the Great conquered the known world, including Egypt. He set up his general Ptolemy as the new pharaoh and founded a line of Greek kings to rule over Egypt."
The Ptolemaic section of the hall was shorter and seemed sad compared to all the others. The temples were smaller. The kings and queens looked desperate or lazy or simply apathetic. There were no great battles, except toward the end. I saw Romans march into the city of Alexandria. I saw a woman with dark hair and a white dress drop a snake into her blouse.
"Cleopatra," Zia said. the seventh queen of that name. She tried to stand against the might of Rome, and she lost. When she took her life, the last line of pharaohs ended. Egypt, the great nation, faded. Our language was forgotten. The ancient rites were suppressed. The house of life survived, but we were forced into hiding. We passed into an area of red light, and history began to look familiar. I saw Arab armies riding into Egypt, then the Turks. Napoleon marched his army under the shadow of the pyramids. The British came and built the Suez Canal. Slowly, Cairo grew into a modern city, and the old ruins faded farther and farther under the sands of the desert. Each year, Zia said, the Hall of Ages grows longer to encompass our history, up until the present. I was so dazed I didn't even realize we'd reached the end of the hall until Sadie grabbed my arm. In front of us stood a dais, and on it an empty throne, a gilded wooden chair with a flail and a shepherd's crook carved in the back, the ancient symbols of the pharaoh. On the step below the throne sat the oldest man I'd ever seen. His skin was like lunch bag paper, brown, thin, and crinkled. White linen robes hung loosely off his small frame. A leopard's skin was draped around his shoulders, and his hand shakily held a big wooden staff, which I was sure he was going to drop any minute. But weirdest of all, the glowing hieroglyphs in the air seemed to be coming from him. Multicolored symbols popped up all around him and floated away as if he were some sort of magic bubble machine. At first, I wasn't sure he was even alive. His milky eyes stared into space. Then he focused on me, and electricity coursed through my body. He wasn't just looking at me. He was scanning me, reading my entire being. "Hide," something inside me said. I didn't know where the voice came from, but my stomach clenched. My whole body tensed as if I were bracing for a hit, and the electrical feeling subsided. The old man raised an eyebrow as if I'd surprised him. He glanced behind him and said something in a language I didn't recognize. A second man stepped out of the shadows. I wanted to yelp. He was the guy who'd been with Zia in the British Museum. The one with the cream-colored robes and the forked beard. The bearded man glared at Sadie and me.
"I am Desjardins," he said with a French accent. "My master, Chief Lector Iskander, welcomes you to the House of Life."
I couldn't think what to say to that, so of course I asked a stupid question. He's really old. Why isn't he sitting on the throne?
Desjardins' nostrils flared, but the old dude, Iskander, just chuckled and said something else in that other language. Desjardins translated stiffly.
"The master says thank you for noticing. He is, in fact, really old. But the throne is for the pharaoh. It has been vacant since the fall of Egypt to Rome. It is, comment dit-on, symbolic. The chief lector's role is to serve and protect the pharaoh. Therefore, he sits at the foot of the throne."
I looked at Iskander a little nervously. I wondered how many years he'd been sitting on that step.
If he can understand English, what language is he speaking?
Desjardins sniffed.
"The chief lector understands many things. But he prefers to speak Alexandrian Greek, his birth tongue."
Sadie cleared her throat. "Sorry, his birth tongue? Wasn't Alexander the Great way back in the blue section, thousands of years ago? You make it sound like Lord Salamander is..."
"Lord Iskander!"
Desjardins hissed.
"Show respect!"
Something clicked in my mind. Back in Brooklyn, Amos had talked about the magician's law against summoning gods, a law made in Roman times by the chief lector, Iskander. Surely it had to be a different guy. Maybe we were talking to Iskander the 27th or something. The old man looked me in the eyes. He smiled as if he knew exactly what I was thinking. He said something else in Greek, and Desjardins translated.
The master says not to worry. You will not be held responsible for the past crimes of your family. At least, not until we have investigated you further.
Gee, thanks, I said.
Do not mock our generosity, boy,
Desjardins warned.
Your father broke our most important law twice. Once at Cleopatra's Needle, when he tried to summon the gods, and your mother died assisting him. Then again at the British Museum, when your father was foolish enough to use the Rosetta Stone itself. Now your uncle, too, is missing.
You know what's happened to Amos? Sadie blurted out.
Desjardins scowled. Not yet,
he admitted.
You have to find him, Sadie cried. Don't you have some sort of GPS magic or...
We are searching, Desjardins said. But you cannot worry about Amos. You must stay here. You must be trained.
I got the impression he was going to say a different word, something not as nice as trained. Iskandar spoke directly to me. His tone sounded kindly.
The master warns that the demon days begin tomorrow at sunset,
Desjardins translated.
You must be kept safe.
But we have to find our dad, I said. Dangerous gods are on the loose out there. We saw Serket and Set.
At these names, Iskander's expression tightened. He turned and gave Desjardins what sounded like an order. Desjardins protested. Iskandar repeated his statement. Desjardins clearly didn't like it, but he bowed to his master. Then he turned toward me.
The chief lector wishes to hear your story.
So I told him, with Sadie jumping in whenever I stopped to take a breath. The funny thing was, we both left out certain things without planning to. We didn't mention Sadie's magic abilities or the encounter with the Ba who'd called me a king. It was like I literally couldn't mention those things. Whenever I tried, the voice inside my head whispered,
"Not that part. Be silent."
When I was done, I glanced at Zia. She said nothing, but she was studying me with a troubled expression. Iskandar traced a circle on the step with the butt of his staff. More hieroglyphs popped into the air and floated away. After several seconds, Desjardins seemed to grow impatient. He stepped forward and glared at us.
"You are lying. That could not have been Set. He would need a powerful host to remain in this world. Very powerful."
"Look, you," Sadie said. "I don't know what all this rubbish is about hosts, but I saw Set with my own eyes. You were there at the British Museum. You must have done too. And if Carter saw him in Phoenix, Arizona, then..."
She looked at me doubtfully.
"Then he's probably not crazy."
"Thanks, sis," I mumbled. But Sadie was just getting started.
"And as for Serket, she's real too. Our friend, my cat, Bast, died protecting us."
"So," Desjardins said coldly, "you admit to consulting with gods. That makes our investigation much easier. Bast is not your friend. The gods caused the downfall of Egypt. It is forbidden to call on their powers. Magicians are sworn to keep the gods from interfering in the mortal world. We must use all our power to fight them."
"Bast said you were paranoid," Sadie added. The magician clenched his fists, and the air tingled with the weird smell of ozone, like during a thunderstorm. The hairs on my neck stood straight up. Before anything bad could happen, Zia stepped in front of us.
"Lord Desjardins," she pleaded, "there was something strange. When I ensnared the scorpion goddess, she reformed almost instantly. I could not return her to the Duat, even with the 7 ribbons. I could only break her hold on the host for a moment. Perhaps the rumors of other escapes.
What other escapes? I asked. She glanced at me reluctantly.
Other gods, many of them, released since last night from artifacts all over the world, like a chain reaction.
Zia! Desjardins snapped. That information is not for sharing.
Look, I said, Lord, sir, whatever. Bast warned us this would happen. She said Set would release more gods.
Master, Zia pleaded, if Ma'at is weakening, if Set is increasing chaos, perhaps that is why I could not banish Circuit.
Ridiculous, Desjardins said. You are skilled, Zia, but perhaps you were not skilled enough for this encounter. And as for these two, the contamination must be contained.
Zia's face reddened. She turned her attention to Iskandar.
Master, please, give me a chance with them.
You forget your place, Desjardins snapped. These two are guilty and must be destroyed.
My throat started closing up. I looked at Sadie. If we had to make a run for it down that long hall, I didn't like our chances. The old man finally looked up. He smiled at Zia with true affection. For a second I wondered if she were his great-great-great-granddaughter or something. He spoke in Greek, and Zia bowed deeply.
Desjardins looked ready to explode.
He swept his robes away from his feet and marched behind the throne.
The chief lector will allow Zia to test you, he growled. Meanwhile, I will seek out the truth, or the lies, in your story. You will be punished for the lies.
I turned to Iskandar and copied Zia's bow. Sadie did the same.
Thank you, Master, I said.
The old man studied me for a long time. Again, I felt as if he were trying to burn into my soul, not in an angry way, more out of concern. Then he mumbled something, and I understood two words. Necta Nebo and Ba. He opened his hand and a flood of glowing hieroglyphs poured out, swarming around the dais. There was a blinding flash of light, and when I could see again, the dais was empty. The two men were gone. Zia turned toward us, her expression grim.
I will show you to your quarters. In the morning, your testing begins. We will see what magic you know and how you know it.
I wasn't sure what she meant by that, but I exchanged an uneasy look with Sadie.
Sounds fun, Sadie ventured. And if we fail this test?
Zia regarded her coldly.
This is not the sort of test you fail, Sadie Kane. You pass, or you die.
15. A Godly Birthday Party. They took Carter to a different dormitory, so I don't know how he slept, but I couldn't get a wink. It would have been hard enough with Zia's comments about passing our tests or dying, but the girls' dormitory just wasn't as posh as Amos's mansion. The stone walls sweated moisture. Creepy pictures of Egyptian monsters danced across the ceiling in the torchlight. I got a floating cot to sleep in, and the other girls in training, initiates, Zia had called them, were much younger than me. So when the old dorm matron told them to go to sleep straight away, they actually obeyed. The matron waved her hand, and the torches went out. She shut the door behind her, and I could hear the sound of locks clicking. Lovely. Imprisoned in a nursery school dungeon. I stared into the dark until I heard the other girls snoring. A single thought kept bothering me, an urge I just couldn't shake. Finally, I crept out of bed and tugged on my boots. I felt my way to the door. I tugged at the handle. Locked, as I suspected. I was tempted to kick it, till I remembered what Zia had done in the Cairo airport broom closet. I pressed my palm against the door and whispered, Sahad! Locks clicked, the door swung open. Handy trick! Outside, the corridors were dark and empty. Apparently there wasn't much nightlife in the first gnome. I sneaked through the city back the way we'd come and saw nothing but an occasional cobra slithering across the floor. After the last couple of days, that didn't even faze me. I thought about trying to find Carter, but I wasn't sure where they'd taken him, and honestly, I wanted to do this on my own. After our last argument in New York, I wasn't sure how I felt about my brother. The idea that he could be jealous of my life while he got to travel the world with Dad, please. And he had the nerve to call my life normal. All right, I had a few mates at school, like Liz and Emma, but my life was hardly easy. If Carter made a social faux pas or met people he didn't like, he could just move on. I had to stay put. I couldn't answer simple questions like, where are your parents, or what does your family do, or even where are you from, without exposing just how odd my situation was. I was always the different girl, the mixed-race girl, the American who wasn't American, the girl whose mother had died, the girl with the absent father, the girl who made trouble in class, the girl who couldn't concentrate on her lessons. After a while, one learns that blending in simply doesn't work. If people are going to single me out, I might as well give them something to stare at. Red stripes in my hair? Why not? Combat boots with the school uniform? Absolutely. Headmaster says, I'll have to call your parents, young lady. I say, good luck. Carter didn't know anything about my life. But enough of that. The point was, I decided to do this particular bit of exploring alone, and after a few wrong turns, I found my way back to the Hall of Ages. What was I up to, you may ask? I certainly didn't want to meet Monsieur Evil again, or creepy old Lord Salamander, but I did want to see those images, memories, Zia had called them. I pushed open the bronze doors. Inside, the hall seemed deserted. No balls of fire floated around the ceiling, no glowing hieroglyphs, but images still shimmered between the columns, washing the hall with strange, multicolored light. I took a few nervous steps. I wanted another look at the Age of the Gods. On our first trip through the hall, something about those images had shaken me. I knew Carter thought I'd gone into a dangerous trance, and Zia had warned that the scenes would melt my brain. But I had a feeling she was just trying to scare me off. I felt a connection to those images, like there was an answer within, a vital piece of information I needed. I stepped off the carpet and approached the curtain of golden light. I saw sand dunes shifting in the wind, storm clouds brewing, crocodiles sliding down the Nile. I saw a vast hall full of revelers. I touched the image. And I was in the Palace of the Gods. Huge beings swirled around me, changing shape from human to animal to pure energy. On a throne in the center of the room sat a muscular African man in rich black robes. He had a handsome face and warm brown eyes. His hands looked strong enough to crush rocks. The other gods celebrated round him. Music played, a sound so powerful that the air burned. At the man's side stood a beautiful woman in white, her belly swollen as if she were a few months pregnant. Her form flickered. At times she seemed to have multicolored wings. Then she turned in my direction, and I gasped. She had my mother's face. She didn't seem to notice me. In fact, none of the gods did, until a voice behind me said, "Are you a ghost?" I turned and saw a good-looking boy of about 16 dressed in black robes. His complexion was pale, but he had lovely brown eyes like the man on the throne. His black hair was long and tousled, rather wild, but it worked for me. He tilted his head, and it finally occurred to me that he'd asked me a question. I tried to think of something to say. "Excuse me? Hello? Marry me?" Anything would have done, but all I could manage was a shake of the head. "Not a ghost, eh?" he mused. "A bar, then?" He gestured towards the throne. "Watch, but do not interfere." Somehow I wasn't interested in watching the throne so much, but the boy in black dissolved into a shadow and disappeared, leaving me no further distraction.
Isis, said the man on the throne.
The pregnant woman turned towards him and beamed.
My lord Osiris, happy birthday. Thank you, my love, and soon we shall mark the birth of our son, Horus, the Great One. His new incarnation shall be his greatest yet. He shall bring peace and prosperity to the world.
Isis took her husband's hand. Music kept playing around them, gods celebrating, the very air swirling in a dance of creation. Suddenly the palace doors blew open. A hot wind made the torches sputter. A man strode into the hall. He was tall and strong, almost a twin to Osiris, but with dark red skin, blood-coloured robes, and a pointed beard. He looked human, except when he smiled. Then his teeth turned to fangs. His face flickered, sometimes human, sometimes strangely wolf-like. I had to stifle a scream, because I'd seen that wolfish face before. The dancing stopped. The music died. Osiris rose from his throne.
Set, he said in a dangerous tone. Why have you come?
Set laughed, and the tension in the room broke. Despite his cruel eyes, he had a wonderful laugh, nothing like the screeching he'd done at the British Museum. It was carefree and friendly, as if he couldn't possibly mean any harm.
I come to celebrate my brother's birthday, of course,
he exclaimed.
And I bring entertainment.
He gestured behind him. Four huge men with the heads of wolves marched into the room, carrying a jewel-encrusted golden coffin. My heart began to race. It was the same box Set had used to imprison my dad at the British Museum. No, I wanted to scream. Don't trust him. But the assembled gods oohed and aahed, admiring the box, which was painted with gold and red hieroglyphs, trimmed with jade and opals. The wolfmen set down the box, and I saw it had no lid. The interior was lined with black linen.
This sleeping casket, Set announced, was made by my finest craftsmen, using the most expensive materials. Its value is beyond measure. The god who lies within, even for a night, will see his powers increase tenfold. His wisdom will never falter. His strength will never fail. It is a gift.
He smiled slyly at Osiris.
For the one and only god who fits within perfectly.
I wouldn't have queued up first, but the gods surged forward. They pushed each other out of the way to get at the golden coffin. Some climbed in but were too short, others were much too big. Even when they tried to change their shapes, the gods had no luck, as if the magic of the box were thwarting them. No one fit exactly. Gods grumbled and complained as others, anxious to try, pushed them to the floor. Set turned to Osiris with a good-natured laugh.
Well, brother, we have no winner yet. Will you try? Only the best of the gods can succeed.
Osiris's eyes gleamed. Apparently he wasn't the god of brains, because he seemed completely taken in by the box's beauty. All the other gods looked at him expectantly, and I could see what he was thinking. If he fit the box, what a brilliant birthday present. Even Set, his wicked brother, would have to admit that he was the rightful king of the gods. Only Isis seemed troubled. She laid her hand on her husband's shoulder.
My lord, do not. Set does not bring presents. I am offended.
Set sounded genuinely hurt.
Can I not celebrate my brother's birthday? Are we so estranged that I cannot even apologize to the king?
Osiris smiled at Isis.
My dear, it is only a game. Fear nothing.
He rose from his throne. The gods applauded as he approached the box.
All hail, Osiris!
Set cried. The king of the gods lowered himself into the box, and when he glanced in my direction, just for a moment, he had my father's face. No, I thought again, don't do it. But Osiris lay down. The coffin fit him exactly. A cheer went up from the gods, but before Osiris could rise, Set clapped his hands. A golden lid materialized above the box and slammed down on top of it. Osiris shouted in rage, but his cries were muffled. Golden latches fastened around the lid. The other gods surged forward to intervene. Even the boy in black I'd seen earlier reappeared, but Set was faster. He stamped his foot so hard the stone floor trembled. The gods toppled over each other like dominoes. The wolfmen drew their spears and the gods scrambled away in terror. Set said a magic word and a boiling cauldron appeared out of thin air. It poured its contents over the coffin, molten lead coating the box, sealing it shut, probably heating the interior to 1,000 degrees. "Villain!" Isis wailed. She advanced on Set and began to speak a spell, but Set held up his hand. Isis rose from the floor, clawing at her mouth, her lips pressed as if an invisible force was suffocating her.
"Not today, lovely Isis," Set purred. "Today I am king, and your child shall never be born."
Suddenly, another goddess, a slender woman in a blue dress, charged out of the crowd. "Husband, no!" She tackled Set, who momentarily lost his concentration. Isis fell to the floor, gasping. The other goddess yelled, "Flee!" Isis turned and ran. Set rose. I thought he would hit the goddess in blue, but he only snarled,
"Foolish wife, whose side are you on?"
He stamped his foot again, and the golden coffin sank into the floor. Set raced after Isis. At the edge of the palace, Isis turned into a small bird of prey and soared into the air. Set sprouted demon's wings and launched himself in pursuit. Then suddenly, I was the bird. I was Isis, flying desperately over the Nile. I could sense Set behind me, closing, closing. "You must escape," the voice of Isis said in my mind. "Avenge Osiris, crown Horus king." Just when I thought my heart would burst, I felt a hand on my shoulder. The images evaporated. The old master, Iskandar, stood next to me, his face pinched with concern. Glowing hieroglyphs danced round him.
"Forgive the interruption," he said in perfect English, "but you were almost dead."
That's when my knees turned to water and I lost consciousness. When I awoke, I was curled at Iskandar's feet on the steps below the empty throne. We were alone in the hall, which was mostly dark except for the light from the hieroglyphs that always seemed to glow around him.
"Welcome back," he said. "You're lucky you survived."
I wasn't so sure. My head felt like it had been boiled in oil. "I'm sorry," I said. "I didn't mean to..."
"Look at the images, and yet you did. Your Ba left your body and entered the past. Hadn't you been warned?"
"Yes," I admitted, "but I was drawn to the pictures."
"Hmm."
Iskandar stared into space, as if remembering something from long ago.
"They are hard to resist."
"You speak perfect English," I noticed. Iskandar smiled.
"How do you know I am speaking English? Perhaps you are speaking Greek."
I hoped he was kidding, but I couldn't tell. He seemed so frail and warm, and yet it was like sitting next to a nuclear reactor. I had a feeling he was full of more danger than I wanted to know. "You're not really that old, are you?" I asked. "I mean, old enough to remember Ptolemaic times."
"I am exactly that old, my dear. I was born in the reign of Cleopatra the VII. "Oh, please. I assure you, it's true. It was my sorrow to behold the last days of Egypt before that foolhardy queen lost her kingdom to the Romans. I was the last magician to be trained before the house went underground. Many of our most powerful secrets were lost, including the spells my master used to extend my life. Magicians these days still live long, sometimes centuries, but I have been alive for 2 millennia.
So, you're immortal. His chuckle turned into a racking cough. He doubled over and cupped his hands over his mouth. I wanted to help, but I wasn't sure how. The glowing hieroglyphs flickered and dimmed around him. Finally, the coughing subsided. He took a shaky breath.
Hardly immortal, my dear. In fact...
His voice trailed off.
But never mind that. What did you see in your vision?
I probably should have kept quiet. I didn't want to be turned into a bug for breaking any rules, and the vision had terrified me, especially the moment when I'd changed into the bird of prey. But Iskandar's kindly expression made it hard to hold back. I ended up telling him everything. Well, almost everything. I left out the bit about the good-looking boy. And yes, I know it was silly, but I was embarrassed. I reckoned that part could have been my own crazed imagination at work, as ancient Egyptian gods could not have been that gorgeous. Iskandar sat for a moment, tapping his staff against the steps.
You saw a very old event, Zadie. Set taking the throne of Egypt by force. He hid Osiris's coffin, you know, and Isis searched the entire world to find it.
So she got him back eventually?
Not exactly. Osiris was resurrected, but only in the underworld. He became the king of the dead. When their son, Horus, grew up, Horus challenged Set for the throne of Egypt and won after many hard battles. That is why Horus was called the Avenger. As I said, an old story, but one that the gods have repeated many times in our history.
Repeated?
The gods follow patterns. In some ways they are quite predictable, acting out the same squabbles, the same jealousies down through the ages. Only the settings change, and the hosts.
There was that word again, hosts. I thought about the poor woman in the New York Museum who turned into the goddess Circuit. In my vision, I said, Isis and Osiris were married. Horus was about to be born as their son. But in another story Carter told me, all three of them were siblings, children of the sky goddess.
Yes, Iskandar agreed. This can be confusing for those who do not know the nature of gods. They cannot walk the earth in their pure form, at least not for more than a few moments. They must have hosts.
Humans, you mean?
Or powerful objects, such as statues, amulets, monuments, certain models of cars. But they prefer human form. You see, gods have great power, but only humans have creativity. The power to change history rather than simply repeat it. Humans can, how do you modern say it, think outside the cup.
The box, I suggested?
Yes. The combination of human creativity and godly power can be quite formidable. At any rate, when Osiris and Isis first walked the earth, their hosts were brother and sister. But mortal hosts are not permanent. They die. They wear out. Later in history, Osiris and Isis took new forms. Humans who were husband and wife. Horus, who in one lifetime was their brother, was born into a new life as their son.
That's confusing, I said, and a little gross. Iskandar shrugged.
The gods do not think of relationships the way we humans do. Their hosts are merely like changes of clothes. This is why the ancient stories seem so mixed up. Sometimes the gods are described as married, or siblings, or parent and child, depending on their hosts. The pharaoh himself was called a living god, you know. Egyptologists believe this was just a lot of propaganda, but in fact, it was often literally true. The greatest of the pharaohs became hosts for gods, usually Horus. He gave them power and wisdom and let them build Egypt into a mighty empire.
But that's good, isn't it? Why is it against the law to host a god? Iskandar's face darkened.
Gods have different agendas than humans do, Sadie. They can overpower their hosts, literally burn them out. That is why so many hosts die young. Tutankhamun, poor boy, died at 19. Cleopatra VII was even worse. She tried to host the spirit of Isis without knowing what she was doing, and it shattered her mind. In the old days, the House of Life taught the use of divine magic. Initiates could study the path of Horus, or Isis, or Sekhmet, or any number of gods, learning to channel their powers. We had many more initiates back then.
Iskandar looked round the empty hall, as if imagining it filled with magicians.
Some adepts could call upon the gods only from time to time. Others attempted to host their spirits with varying degrees of success. The ultimate goal was to become the Eye of the God, a perfect union of the two souls, mortal and immortal. Very few achieved this, even among the pharaohs, who were born to the task. Many destroyed themselves trying.
He turned up his palm, which had the most deeply etched lifeline I've ever seen.
When Egypt finally fell to the Romans, it became clear to us, to me, that mankind, our rulers, even the strongest magicians, no longer had the strength of will to master a god's power. The only ones who could...
His voice faltered. What?
Nothing, my dear. I talk too much. An old man's weakness.
It's the blood of the pharaohs, isn't it? He fixed me in his gaze. His eyes no longer looked milky. They burned with intensity.
You are a remarkable young girl. You remind me of your mother.
My mouth fell open. You knew her?
Of course. She trained here, as did your father. Your mother, well, aside from being a brilliant scientist, she had the gift of divination, one of the most difficult forms of magic, and she was the first in centuries to possess it.
Divination?
Seeing the future. Tricky business, never perfect. But she saw things that made her seek advice from unconventional places. Things that made even this old man question some long-held beliefs.
He drifted off into memory land again, which was infuriating enough when my grandparents did it. But when it's an all-powerful magician who has valuable information, it's enough to drive one mad. Iskandar? He looked at me with mild surprise, as if he'd forgotten I was there.
I'm sorry, Sadie. I should have come to the point. You have a hard path ahead of you, but I'm convinced now it's a path you must take for all our sakes. Your brother will need your guidance.
I was tempted to laugh. Carter? Need my guidance? For what? What path do you mean?
All in good time. Things must take their course.
Typical adult answer. I tried to bite back my frustration. And what if I need guidance?
Zia, he said without hesitation. She is my best